continue to impose upon her both the male housing facility in the form of the disciplinary barracks at Leavenworth, but they're also forcing her to maintain her male the male hair length standards and grooming standards. And that is something that we're fighting in court. And the perils and the damages of being forced to be punished through the denial of your core identity is something that has led to her depression. It's imperiled her health, and it's something that many transgender people across the country are facing on a daily basis.
Very quickly, we have 30 seconds. Talk about HB2 and the hearing this week.
So in North Carolina, the ACLU and Lambda Legal are headed to trial against North Carolina's anti-trans law. We had our first hearing this week down in North Carolina. It is going to be an ongoing fight to take down that law and other anti-trans laws. And we're going to be doing that in the context in which we know that so many trans women of color are being murdered on the streets. And we have a responsibility to fight back against all of the ways our communities continue to be targeted and killed in prisons, by laws, and by people on the streets.
Chase, we're going to continue this interview right after the show, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Chase Strangio, staff attorney at the ACLU, representing Chelsea Manning in a lawsuit against the Pentagon. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Malkoff, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nagara, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Go to our website for all our coverage of these elections at democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and that was John Trudell, All There Is To It. Always good to start the day with a little John Trudell. And we have on the line a guest all the way from Belize in Central America. I believe they're facing a hurricane, so maybe we'll get a first-person update on that. Guy McPherson, ecologist and evolutionary biologist who coined the term near-term human extinction, but of course that's not his only distinction. He taught for many years, I think about 20, at the University of Arizona, where he's still a professor emeritus. He has been focusing on climate change and abrupt accelerating climate change now for quite some time, and he's kind of carved out a niche talking about the imminent demise of our beloved species due to the rapid habitat loss and the accelerating global warming. He splits his time between a homestead, I understand he has, in southern New Mexico, and a new place he's got in Belize, where he is now. He will be coming to the Pacific Northwest next week, and he'll be starting out in Portland next Monday, August 8th. is Abrupt Climate Change in Cascadia Tour. He's going to be speaking at the Waypost. That's at 3120 North Williams Avenue here in Portland from 6:30 to 9 p.m. I titled this program, The Banality of Annihilation. Some people might be familiar with the term, The Banality of Evil, which was coined by Hannah Arendt in her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, on the trial of the chief architect of the Nazi Final Solution, the genocide of the Jewish people of Germany and Eastern Europe. Her controversial use of the phrase described how the actions of Eichmann, which were so obscene in their nature and consequences, were banal in the sense that they were carried out in a rather unthinking, routine, and bureaucratic manner. Arendt concluded that that far from exhibiting a malevolent hatred of Jews, which could have accounted psychologically for his participation in the Holocaust, Eichmann was an utterly innocuous individual and I would say representative, although of course there were psychopaths, sociopaths, and others among the Nazis. Generally, it was the scary thing, perhaps the scariest thing about it was the routinization of death. Similarly, the entire human race seems to be heading towards unimaginable horrors due to irreversible climate change, yet we by and large go about our lives as if things are more or less normal, and we are all, to a greater or lesser extent, participating in this climate holocaust by routinely living in and fueling what McPherson calls the heat engine of civilization. And of course, there are the counterparts to Eichmann in government, industry, and finance, like the CEOs of ExxonMobil, BP, and Shell, who are playing a more active role in engineering our annihilation. Unfortunately, this time, likely there won't be a post-war reconstruction or a Nuremberg tribunal. So with that lengthy introduction, good morning, Guy. Is he still? Pretty good. So is there a hurricane coming your way down there?
There is. It looks like it's headed in rain. In fact, seems like Thursday will be the eye of the storm.
Huh. The quality, unfortunately, is not happening. There seems to be an echo. I don't know what we can do about that.
Let me try this.
There.
Is this any better?
That's much, much better. Thank you. Yes. So, okay. You heard my introduction, and you're going to be coming here to Portland. You know, one thing I kind of wanted to start out with, you have this new piece called The Politics and Science of Our Demise, and in it, you kind of start out by quoting Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and this is something I've been thinking about just so much, because, you know, I've been talking about this issue of climate change and abrupt climate change. I started out by talking about for the last couple years, extensively covering the efforts of people to, myself included, to stop the expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure, pipelines, export terminals, and the like, to seemingly try to stave off the kind of disastrous effects that you're focusing on. But at the same time, I gotten more and more into actually talking to the science, some of the kind of cutting edge scientists who are observing what's happening and saying that what's actually happening is actually far beyond what has been modeled and what has been being largely put out there by the more official establishment scientific organizations like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So you quote Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Anyway, so what I'm saying is that I've been struggling with how to talk about this issue, how rapidly things seems to be unraveling in our climate and how difficult that is to face both personally and collectively. So she says in her famous book on death and dying, those patients who were told of their fatal diagnosis without a chance, without a sense of hope, reacted the worst and never quite reconciled themselves with the person who presented the news to them in this cruel manner. And you kind of liken yourself to being in that position of giving a fatal diagnosis and the kind of consequences that has had for you both personally and professionally, and in relation to your personal relationships. So maybe we could start out talking about that.
Yeah, I think she nailed it. And I've been in public about the topic for a little over 4 years now. And she knows it's considered fun. So I started for the
past. Well, you're breaking up again. You're breaking up again. I don't know what you did before to make it better.
Before I took you off speakerphone. I can only do that once, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I was afraid this might be problematic. This may not work. But maybe if you move around a little bit. It's not making for great radio.
I'm trying it now.
Okay. So anyway, you're talking about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her book On Death and Dying.
Right. And by presenting the information as I initially did, that presenting the cold, hard facts leading to her eyes, it really turned out off. And in retrospect, I should have reread Elizabeth West from...
Okay. Well, this isn't going to work. I apologize to our listeners and I apologize to you. So we're just going to have to cut it, and I'm just going to have to improvise for this hour. But I will remind people that you will be here next Monday at the Waypost, 3120 North Williams, where people can talk to you in person and hear what you have to say. So we're just going to have to cut this right there because it's just not going to work. Sorry about that, Guy.
No, I'm sorry for the poor connection.
Okay. And that was Guy McPherson speaking to us briefly from Belize. And so we've got 50 minutes, and the number here to talk to me is 503-231-8187. I'm just going to read a little bit from this new piece. He has a website, guymcpherson.com, and he's also got a blog called Nature Bats Last. That's an old Earth First slogan. So I'm just going to start from the beginning. This is called The Politics and Science of Our Demise. This is written this past Monday, August 1st. Starts out with a quote from Carl Sagan, "Extinction is the rule, survival is the exception," by Carl Sagan. No mainstream scientist could talk about near-term human extinction and remain supported in his or her job. Therefore, none do. None go the distance in connecting the dots regarding our imminent demise. Paradoxically, tenure is designed to protect academic freedom. Administrators walk a tightrope as they promote the insanity of the dominant paradigm in the name of money while simultaneously paying lip service to academic freedom. I'll make it personal. While quoting Elizabeth Kubler-Ross from her famous book On Death and Dying, those patients who are told of their fatal diagnosis without a chance, without a sense of hope, react to the worst and never quite reconcile themselves with the person who presented the news to them in this cruel manner. In the latter pages of her 1969 book, Kubler-Ross warned me, I think he's saying that, not. I don't think she was speaking to him directly, but that's what he took out of it, not to steal hope from my audience. And this is a Guy McPherson speaking. In doing so, most of the people previously part of my life have failed to reconcile themselves with the person who presented the news to them in this honest manner. As with my personal life, I took a radical approach in my classrooms for a very long time. In return, I had an NSA-contracted spy in my classroom no later than 2005, and my final department head was hired specifically to make my life miserable enough that I'd leave. After all, it's nearly impossible to fire a tenured full professor with the record I had established. To be clear to my detractors, for about the thousandth time, I left active service voluntarily because I was unwilling to continue my participation within an irredeemably corrupt system. He's talking about the university system, but I think more generally. My forthcoming Cascadian speaking tour will focus on the politics and science of abrupt climate change. I'll tell a few stories from this politics underlying the scientific endeavor, and then focus on Sam Carana's recent analysis. The latter, in which Carana ponders a global average temperature rise of more than 10 degrees centigrade above baseline, and baseline is basically the beginning of the Industrial Revolution set around arbitrarily in 1750. A global average temperature rise of more than 10 degrees centigrade above baseline within a decade from now is the focus of this brief essay. Evidence underlying this essay can be found, as usual, within long, often updated climate change summary and update, which is, again, on guymcpherson.com. The evidence is real, regardless who uncovers it. Karana probably is at least two anonymous people. He makes mistakes like everybody else, but her lack of credentials does not obviate her findings. But I repeat myself. Karana's analysis is good. He is able and willing to connect a few dots on the topic within the arena of abrupt climate change. The resulting analysis is generally quite conservative, although I believe He errs on the side of overheating twice. In the first case, He concludes global average temperature has increased 1.92 degrees centigrade since 1850. Although a recent paper indicates direct observations have missed about 20% of global warming since the 1860s, I'll lowball the scientific consensus in going with 1.4 degrees centigrade so far. The second error mentioned below is more substantive, and it matches one I made on a recent speaking tour with respect to moistening of the upper troposphere. Tacking onto the current temperature, the amount of global warming locked in for the next decade adds 0.5 degrees centigrade to the current temperature of Earth. In my case, that takes us to 1.9 degrees Celsius above baseline. Removal of the second of the aerosol masking effect, or global dimming, adds an additional 2.5 degrees. It's guaranteed by high, unstable pressures that preclude large-scale production of grains. The latest journal literature concludes the addition will be about 3 degrees, but I'll take the ultra-conservative approach and side with Karana on this one. Albedo effect changes in the Arctic in light of rapidly diminishing ice, and that's albedo effect is the reflectivity of the ice, the fact that light ice and snow reflect solar radiation rather than dark land and sea, which absorb it. Albedo change in the Arctic add another 1.6 degrees Celsius to the total. This addition results from Peter Wadham's work in 2012, concluding that energy absorption will increase by more than 2 watts per square meter. Already, absorption has increased from 0.43 watts per square meter during the period between 1970 and 1992 to 0.75 watts per square meter since 1992. That's a huge change. A near-term ice-free Arctic thus increases global average temperature by 1.6 degrees Celsius in the next 10 years. So basically what this paper by this Sam Karana does is it adds up all the different individual identified drivers of global warming and comes to what Karana adds up to 10 degrees. And Guy McPherson, using a somewhat more conservative approach, comes to 8.21 degree temperature rise within 10 years we're talking about. So according to Karana's analysis, seafloor methane adds only 1.1 degrees centigrade between now and 2026. This figure is stunningly conservative relative to predictions by Natalia Shakova and Paul Beckwith. Therefore, I'll use the conservative figure. Karana adds 2.1 degrees Celsius for extra water vapor feedback. In doing so, he is concluding that essentially all the rise in temperature between 1750 and 2016 is due to carbon dioxide and will be matched by a similar rise in temperature because of water vapor in the near future. A more conservative approach pins the carbon dioxide contributions to 0.8 degrees Celsius and therefore reduces the water vapor feedback to 0.8 degrees Celsius. Thus, I'll subtract 1.3 degrees off Karana's projected water vapor contribution. You don't have to get all these details. Finally, Karana adds 0.3 degrees Celsius for other feedbacks. Considering the latest information about terrestrial permafrost and more than 5 dozen other self-reinforcing feedback loops, this figure seems startlingly conservative. Therefore, I will use it. Habitat for humans on Earth is rapidly diminishing. Wishful thinking aside, cleverness aside, self-proclaimed intelligence aside, human animals will not persist long without habitat. Abrupt climate change has already begun, and the sixth mass extinction is clearly underway. Afflicted by the arrogance of humanism, many members of my species believe the concept of habitat is applicable to other species, but not ours. In total, Corona ends up with 10.02 degrees centigrade above baseline by mid-2026. And again, that's 10 years from now, or about 23.5 degrees centigrade mean annual average temperature. That'd be the highest global average temperature on this planet during the last 2 billion years. Taking a conservative approach at every step, I conclude only an 8.21 degree rise in temperature by mid-2026. As a result, I conclude global average temperature at that time will be about 21.7 degrees Celsius. This is barely below 22 degrees, the temperature which Earth has most commonly found itself during the last 2 billion years. There's no reason to expect Earth to start cooling until the heat engine of civilization is turned off and dozens of self-reinforcing feedback loops are inexplicably reversed. For context, the Great Dying wiped out nearly all complex life on Earth. It involved a global average rise in temperature from about 12 degrees to about 23 degrees during a span of several tens of thousands of years. To conclude, the humans will survive a similar rise in temperature within only a couple hundred years, with the vast majority of the heating occurring within a decade, is exceedingly and probably insanely optimistic. Considering Homo sapiens is strongly dependent upon myriad other species for our own survival, it's difficult to imagine our favorite species will have the habitat requisite for survival as we barrel into 2026, only a decade from now. But perhaps we will survive. Perhaps the heat engine known as civilization will be repaired by soon-to-be-developed tools that cool, developed via the heat engine known as civilization. Perhaps we can bomb the deserts and roam the ocean in nuclear submarines while eating Soylent Green. And then, a few million years later, assuming the planet cools, perhaps we will pop out the other side of a substantial bottleneck in sufficient numbers to do it all over again. Between now and then, I fully expect 10,000 trolls will emerge from beneath 10,000 bridges to claim I'm an extremist, making up the notion of near-term human extinction as a means of generating income for myself. And again, I'm speaking from this article by Guy McPherson, The Politics and Science of Our Demise, just written recently. And he ends up, unicorns and other miracles notwithstanding, our persistence would surprise me. I'm preternaturally inclined toward reality instead of wishful thinking. Perhaps that's my problem. I simply don't wish hard enough. And we'll start out this program. I had planned to have him on, and I had him on briefly at the start of the show. And unfortunately, the connection just was not that great. Maybe Hurricane Earl was messing up the transmission. Anyway, as I said, he will be here next week. You can come and check him out at the Waypost next Monday, August 6th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. and have a rip-roaring conversation. And the number to call in is 503-231-8187. I'm glad to keep talking at you and reading some more of McPherson's work, but I'd rather talk to you. How about those rain bombs? What happened in Ellicott City, similar to what happened in, I think it was Dallas, last month, I believe. It's an amazing amount of rainfall within just a matter of hours. I don't know if you saw those videos of the rain on the street. I saw one that people were watching, you know, kind of sort of amused at first and then turning terrified as the water in the street rose several feet in the matter of like half an hour. Well, it looks like we do have a caller. Barry Joe, you're on the air here on KBOO Community Radio. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
I sure can.
All right. Thanks. We have to find out which end of the line, of course, that the interference is. I'm glad I had a chance to call in. I wanted to give some hope to all this. And I'll start with a little bit of despair. Owing to the cross-cultural contact and the smallpox that was brought to this hemisphere, About 25,000 people died. And the low point for atmospheric carbon is somewhere around 1610, 1614. I can't remember exactly, but that was a product of the farmers dying and those farms reverting to trees. So it is possible for us to grow carbon out of the atmosphere. And I'm suggesting that we do it with cannabis hemp, which we know it is incredibly prolific, and we can make all those tens of thousands of products which would sequester that. And so as soon as we start doing things like making our plastics out of hemp, as we did in this country in the 1930s, it's not very well known, but they had some experimental gardens actually in Oregon. It's not the best climate to grow cannabis because of the seasonal weather patterns, but Nebraska and the Corn Belt states could, Minnesota, for example, could meet that need. And I suggest that if we start using biofuels, what we're doing now is we're taking the fossil fuels, which of course is carbon from millions of years ago, and we're bringing that up here to where we live. And on the ultimate fantasy, we would do exactly the opposite, where we're actually growing the plants, sequestering the carbon, and using the processes, their term came out in the 1930s called chemurgy, C-H-E-M-U-R-G-Y, and that's the approach of meeting our industrial feedstocks from the soil rather from other sources. So
wait a second. What timeline are you talking about, though? Because first of all, let's approach what Guy McPherson said based on this Sam Carana's analysis. And I know I don't know if I'm not a scientist, and you may or may not be yourself. So it's difficult to analyze this data. Certainly, just hearing it briefly like that, but on face value, he's saying that based upon what's already in the atmosphere in terms of carbon, right now we're looking at either an 8 to a 10 degree centigrade rise of temperature within 10 years. So all the if that's true, okay. So the first question is that true or not? So right. let's just say let's just say for the sake of argument it's true. Would all the things that you're talking about actually react in time to make a dent in that? That's the fundamental question I'm posing right now.
Right. Well, we can only judge by previous experiences, but I can
wait
tell
a second.
You,
what do you mean judge by previous experiences?
Well, for example, in India, they had a massive problem with flies. So in order to eradicate the flies, they had some people who...
But what's that got to do with global warming?
I'm going to get there. Okay. How you collectively solve a problem. So anyhow, some people were supposed to have their job, essentially, was to kill flies all the time with a fly swatter. Everybody else was assigned a fly swatter, and if they had the opportunity to kill a fly, they killed the flies. And that worked.
Right, but what does that have to do with global warming?
But doing nothing and doing the opposite of what's good is our current approach. Let's just say that that's going to happen. Well, assuming that an asteroid doesn't hit the Earth in the next 10 years, then these other things are going to come into play or not. And it's our approach to those, and I'm suggesting that people at least acknowledge that we can remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
But can we do it? The question is, can we do it fast enough? That's the question I'm proposing. So, so you need to address on those terms the timeline that I'm proposing here.
Okay. Well, I can suggest from my own experience growing cannabis indoors that the plants themselves make the room dark because they absorb the light. The plants themselves lower the temperature because they absorb the light and turn it into biomass. So. I know from, if you want to call that a scientific approach,
you're still not addressing the argument, but that's okay.
I can't address the argument. Neither, I don't suggest that your caller's offline, out of line in any way. I just want to suggest that until we acknowledge the totality of our options, we could just say it's fatal.
Right. Well, so that's what Guy McPherson is suggesting. But we got a couple other callers.
Oh, thank you so much, Paul.
Yeah, thank you. So again, you know, this is a very difficult argument, and I want to say at the outset, I take absolutely no pleasure in talking about this. I have been a critique of the entire entirety of industrial civilization. I think it has been a terrible mistake, all in all. I think that is, as Guy McPherson calls it, the heat engine that's driving us to our destruction. I think we need to dismantle it decades ago. I failed. We collectively failed. Most people disagreed with me, probably still disagreeing with me, certainly disagree with Guy McPherson and his very extreme statement. But is it true or not? And is it better just not to even think about? These are all very difficult questions. I don't propose to have any final answers, but Jeff is also on the line, so let's go to Jeff.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
And first, I'd like to thank you for covering this issue, even though it's a singularly unpleasant one. And I must say, as someone who's followed climate change and global warming and such for more than 20 years, I find that the idea of extinction in 10 years is staggering, and it's hard to imagine. I certainly don't refute any of these claims, and I've followed some of the analysis from the last two months, particularly that he referred to, and it's so I've been trying to get my mind used to it. But the question I have is what will the world look like as these things change? What can we expect, and kind of how to prepare ourselves as best we can to try to manage under the situation.
Well, I wish Guy was with us, because I think he's been studying this for a lot longer than I have. Some of the things that frighten me the most, I mean, if people have been watching the coral die-offs, what's happened to the oceans is truly, truly concerning, if not absolutely terrifying. The oceans have been one of the major repositories of carbon. They found that there's, I believe it's I'm not sure if it's the South Indian Ocean. Anyway, there's one of the oceans has a large preponderance, and the ability of the oceans to absorb carbon has been rapidly slowing. And the plankton in the oceans, which are also being threatened by acidification and ocean warming, produce a massive amount of the oxygen. And also the forests that ordinarily are a carbon sink, they found that the Amazon forest has been a traditionally a net storer of carbon, is now losing its ability to store carbon. So we're facing the possibility of diminishing oxygen in the atmosphere, which is not a good prospect to contemplate. So I think our engineer said that Guy is back. Is that true? Hello? Liam, did you say Guy is back on the phone? Are you there? I don't hear you.
It's on the radio here.
So I don't know what's going on, but I can't.
I don't call in very often.
Hello? Whoop, that's not working. So I don't know if our previous guest, Jeff, is phoner Jeff, are you still there? He's not there either. So we got open lines, 503-231-8187. Another difficult technical morning here on KBOO. We do the best we can. So I've been talking about Guy McPherson's work, who's a professor of ecology and conservation biology, which led him into looking at species loss, species extinction, and then ultimately looking at climate change. Obviously, the Sonoran Desert down there in Arizona, and some of those mountain areas, the high desert island mountains are some of the kind of canaries in the coal mine, as it were, in terms of climate change, and great laboratories for studying, just as the Arctic is, and the glaciers on the high mountains, all of which are disappearing rapidly. And so we're talking about these rapid, abrupt climate change. Okay, well, Guy, are you with us again? Apparently not. But let's go to our phone caller, Sylvia. Sorry, Liam, this is a very trying experience.
Hello, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm on the line.
You're both online. Yes, you sound great. Well, we got a little less time than we did at the outset, but Guy McPherson is back with us. Thank you. So you probably certainly weren't able to hear all the things I've been doing. I basically read your article, The Politics and Science of Our Demise. I read the entire thing, and I had one caller talk about growing hemp as a response to what's happening. But since Sylvia's on there, let me just have Sylvia ask you a question, and we can get back started. Go ahead, Sylvia.
Oh, yeah, good morning. Actually, I didn't call to have a question. I just wanted to say something from my perspective, which is very, very different.
Okay.
I'm 70 years old, and I cannot deal with any technology. I'm highly allergic to this stuff. I deal directly with Mother Earth, and it's primarily water and rocks. And this has been going on for years, and it has escalated so much so that everything I experience on a soul level, on a conscious level, on an ethical level, parallels everything that you have been saying, what all the scientists are saying, except that I come from the primal thing, the thing that considers the Mother Earth a living being, and the kinds of messages I'm getting by this point, they are so horrific. It's every time I go in the water, and I do that on a daily basis, and there are no words on this, okay? This is it's transmitted without a human language, and at one point it was very clear, stop the machines, stop the poisons, and things like go back to the Stone Age or go extinct. Everything, the way the whole civilization is living, is due. It cannot continue. We cannot have life with, you know, it doesn't work. And everything that I read and everything that I hear is very, very horrific. I'm used to that by now. But what I get wordlessly from the earth herself and from the water, from that consciousness, from that soul, from the water that is no longer water, okay, it is more horrific than anything imaginable. The only way that I can survive this psychically at this point is because I have a homeopath, and we deal on a, you know, on a different level, and it is excruciating. And this is what humans are doing. It is an ethical dilemma. No machine, no technology, none of that is applicable. None of that will provide any kind of solution. It's not the way. So anyway,
well, thank
whatever
you.
It's worth. Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Guy?
I'm not sure how to respond to that. As I started to say at the top of the show, one of the problems I had when I first started transmitting this message is that I'm too left-brained. I'm strictly a rationalist. And so when I would present the facts to people indicating that lack of habitat for humans is virtually certain to rise to extinction in the very near future, I just present this information, and, you know, it's like the medical doctor who comes in and never makes eye contact, looks at the clipboard and tells you got 2 weeks to live, sure to pay the receptionist on the way out. See ya, or not. And so it's difficult for me to even relate to questions that are not rooted in science, not rooted in what I would consider reason or a rational way of tackling the issue.
Okay. Well, we have another caller, Leanne.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. I'm interested in sort of the idea of how this might progress toward, you know, our extinction and the unfolding that we can expect. There's a lot of things going on, everything from, you know, the rapid emission of methane from the Arctic, which has the potential to increase, you know, more concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and cause, like, immediate heating. Everything, you know, to the global dimming aspect of, you know, when civilization ultimately can't go on anymore, not having those particulates. And so I'm interested in finding out or just getting his thoughts a little bit more on you know, how the melting of the ice might play a role and just a little bit more of how he sees this thing playing out and in the next decade.
Well, that's the $64 million question for us, isn't it? And it's sort of analogous to a question they get after almost every presentation. It was down to when I personally going to die, or what day is our species going to go extinct? And we don't really know. You know, we see events playing out in real time now that were predicted decades ago as the kinds of things that would happen decades from then. So we're seeing refugees, for example, 19.2 million of them last year in 2015. We are seeing, in addition to refugee crisis, which is triggered by people no longer having habitat where they formerly lived, we're also seeing food and water shortages. Right now, 4 billion people, that's more than half the people on the planet. 4 billion people don't have daily access to potable water. So there are all kinds of things going on right now that have been predicted for a long time, and they're clearly accelerating. At what point does that mean a loss of habitat for you, for your neighborhood? I don't really know, but we're headed for a global temperature characteristic of the time that there were dinosaurs roaming the earth. They were the dominant species, and the largest mammal was the size of a shrew, and we're headed there in the very short term. It's hard for me to imagine much complex life on the planet, much multicellular life on the planet surviving that. But I'm fully reminded that I don't know what I'm talking about. So maybe this is one of those times.
Well, we got another caller. Kyle is back on. Go ahead, Kyle.
Yeah, good morning.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you see there?
Yeah, go ahead. We're waiting.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Very interesting conversation. You know, and I was just thinking to myself, this is really a bad time to stop smoking, you know, because I might as well not. I mean, you know, I've been looking at this for many years. I've been listening to you for years as well. You know, I've been looking at the results, and I read science articles all the time. And I agree totally. I think that, you know, it's pretty simple right now. All you need to do is take the temperature rise for the last 20 years and continue it on that chart, that graph, for another 10, 15 years, and you'll see exactly what he's talking about. That temperature just keeps going up, and that's a very easy way to do it. You know, short of a Manhattan Project for the world, not just for the United States, but a UN-sponsored Manhattan Project where we paint every single road and every single roof white to reflect the heat away from the planet. And, you know, perhaps with some technology, we may be able to dim it a small amount. But another problem we have is that the particle rate in the atmosphere is dropping now that we're reducing the pollution in the atmosphere. And that's a problem because that reflects the heat into the space. And as you reduce the particulate matter, the heat continues to build and build, and it goes the other direction. So we're actually now getting a slingshot effect where it's really going in quickly. And I think that, this just backs up that McPherson, is that his name?
Uh-huh.
article that, you know, this thing is happening fast, and it's not going to slow down just because we want it to. You know, yeah, there's some technological stuff out there. They just announced that there's a solar panel that acts like a green leaf, and it actually manufactures nap gas or whatever the gas is. You know, it's a burnable gas that they can turn into diesel or whatever. But it takes it out. It takes the carbon out of the atmosphere to do that. Now, perhaps if we did a Manhattan Project on something like that, I believe there's another company out there that said if they covered like 10% of the Sahara Desert with their particular method, they could actually turn carbon into nanoparticles and then reuse it for the next coming industrial age, where everything is going to be built out of carbon nanofiber. If we live that long, but these are all going to take a hugely concerted effort and trillions of dollars, not billions, trillions of dollars contributed to by everybody on this planet. Now, there's a problem there because obviously the politics and McPherson, I'm sorry, did I get your name wrong again?
No, go ahead. Just continue.
You know, the politics are butting right in the way. Oh, I'm almost getting run off the road here by somebody.
Well, anyway, let's let you go, and you can just not get in an accident and hear.
Yeah, I'm parking it right now. Okay. Actually, I just pulled over.
Well, let's hear Guy's response to your discussion of technological solutions.
I'm tired of talking anyway. I've talked about this way too long to too many people to too many friends.
Okay, let's listen to it. Go ahead, Guy.
Well, there's now quite a bit of research literature spearheaded by Tim Garrett, atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah, indicating civilization is a heat engine. And that's where I get that phrase, is from Tim Garrett and his excellent research going back almost a decade now, indicating that civilization, no matter how we power it, is a heat engine. So taking this, quote, civilized approach to dealing with a predicament created by civilization seems somewhat oxymoronic to me. I think that's put in the wrong direction. In addition, there's an article that came out of the Daily Impact just, I think, 3 or 4 days ago. The headline is, "Technology is now cancer, stage 4, metastasized." So it's pretty clear that technology has not delivered all it has promised, and in fact, has not only fallen short in the promises, but created and has in fact become a cancer, stage 4, metastasized. We're addicted to it. We're addicted to the cancer that is killing us all. That's what civilization, the heat engine, is about.
But I think this question is, I'm not sure we've plumbed the depths of this issue. I know in an email exchange with you, I talked about how I've interviewed both Peter Wadhams and Paul Beckwith. Peter Wadhams, of course, is the Arctic sea ice and ocean expert who's done some of the groundbreaking science on pointing to the what's really happening in real time with all these feedback loops, mainly dealing with the Arctic sea ice, but all the feedback mechanisms associated with that, the methane and all the others. And Paul Beckwith, of course, is a graduate student in abrupt climate change and has gotten a fair amount of attention with some of his writings and videos. And both of them recommend what they, you know, what is called geoengineering, which our caller was just mentioning various variants of. And you're basically saying sort of almost on principle that doesn't work. But I think there needs to be get into much more of the specifics about why those things don't work, because I think a lot of people, you know, it's a desperate situation to those who think they understand it in the way that I do. And whether or not that's true, one has to make one's mind up for oneself. But it's a desperate situation, and people are casting about for all kinds of solutions other than our extinction. So, you know, to say something more about geoengineering and proposed technological solutions. Like I just read something, Paul Beckwith just had a post about a new kind of polymer that was discovered that actually absorbs carbon. Of course, it's, you know, years away from application, even if it was something that turned out to be. But what's do you have something against actually like turning, if we could turn all of our research and scientific and technological research and development resources and laboratories away from, say, military and, you know, corporate into, you know, useless consumer goods into actually the best possible solutions, if there are any? Are you on principle against that?
No, I'm obviously not. I'm not promoting near-term human extinction, as I'm often told or is often written about me. It's just that I've actually looked into the evidence, and it's abundant at this point and rooted in the refereed journal literature. Consider, for example, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences issued a report on the 10th of February 2015, including geoengineering is not a viable solution to the climate predicament. This report itself is based on several refereed articles. An analysis in Europe with a similar body reached the same conclusion in an assessment published July 16th, 2015. So there's two large, well-respected scientific bodies, one in Europe and one in the United States, that have poured through the evidence and concluded that geoengineering will not work. Now, I'm not surprised that Paul Beckwith thinks we ought to try that. I think he has not looked into that literature, and as I understand it, he is part of a company that promotes and profits from geoengineering. I'm not promoting near-term human extinction. I am pointing out that the strategies in response to abrupt climate change have so far proved horribly lacking, and continuing to promote them is not going to make it happen. If there was a chance in hell that those kinds of things would work, then don't you think the corporations with the money and the influence and the governments with the money and the influence would be putting some emphasis on them? I think so. I don't think they would turn away and say, well, we have the answer, but we're not going to use it because it's going to cost $12.19.
Well, one could see, one could see that, you know, now there seems to be money in all, you know, quote, alternative energies. And I know there's deep flaws, perhaps fatal flaws, in the idea that so-called renewable energy will get us out of the crisis as well. But there's a complete resistance towards redeploying corporate research and development into those technologies. And so one could, you know, and they could have made a profit on them perhaps earlier. I think there's just a deep inertial resistance. Once you've got a good thing that makes profits, I think one can make that argument that could be a reason why people aren't turning to other solutions, because why mess with a good thing that's making them a bunch of money?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm a big fan of making money, at least for myself. I'm not a fan at all of the monetary system, which creates poverty. But, you know, I'm not anti-money for the sake of being anti-money. There's a solution that's out there. Fine, let's go with it. And I've always taken a Buddha-inspired approach that we should take right action. I just have serious questions about whether continuing to geoengineer through civilization, which has got us to the dagger point, is any sort of solution. I think we're in a predicament. This is not a problem. It's a predicament. There are no politically viable responses to this situation, or we would be using them. They would be applied in an instant. It's not as if the governments are sitting around not knowing about this. It's not as if the governments are sitting around saying, well, we're all going to die. Well, easy come, easy go. That's not the case at all. They know. Well, I know that the evidence indicates that fantasy technology is not going to get us out of this mess. That's the bottom line.
And fundamentally, if one takes that as assumed as true, then the reason why they're not able to change is why.
Well, we've triggered these irreversible self-reinforcing feedback loops. They're irreversible, but temporal span is relevant to an experience. So we can chip away at them all we want. But once we've got methane going exponentially into the atmosphere, once we've got moistening of the upper atmosphere, once we have permafrost melt, there's no reversing those things. We can throw any sort of technology we want that we have at them, and I don't see any evidence that it's going to make a whit of difference. Does that mean we shouldn't? Well, I don't know. Maybe first we should take the Hippocratic approach and do no harm. Maybe instead of continuing to throw civilization at this predicament, we should get over ourselves and conclude that maybe this entire settled arrangements, maybe the entirety of the universe is not designed so that humans can persist in industrial civilization on planet Earth.
So we've got about 5 minutes left. I'm speaking with Guy McPherson, who will be in town next Monday, August 8th. And Sheila is also on the line. Go ahead, Sheila.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm one of these people that thinks that climate change, we can't do anything about it. I mean, that's it. We can't change anything. And to respond to the woman who said, well, how is this going to proceed? My thought is that we either have droughts and floods, which will prevent us from having food sources. The ocean is getting to a point where that will not necessarily provide a food source. And is starvation equally as bad as the heat that we cannot survive in causing our demise?
I couldn't agree more. That, you know, we're talking about habitat, and the primary components of habitat are air, water, and food, and to a lesser extent that we can largely handle with simple technology, the ability to keep temperature in a desirable range. So, yeah, the big pieces of habitat that are concerning for our future are the inability to grow food, the inability to have access to potable water, and those obviously are going to be affected by droughts and floods of, you know, what we're seeing now, droughts and floods of biblical proportions.
Okay, we got one more caller. Harry, go ahead and make your question or comment quick, please.
Okay, yes. The big pink elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about is overpopulation. We have 7 billion people in this earth, and it's still growing. When we breathe in, 320 parts per million of carbon, but when we breathe out, 40,000. And so, and not only that, we each individual usually six pounds of feces and 2 quarts of urine. So I think maybe the problem is we have to reduce our population.
Okay, Guy.
Well, of course, and I've been promoting that idea for my entire career. I'm childless on purpose. And there have been other rational voices during that time, going back to Paul Ehrlich in a book written by his wife, but the publisher wouldn't allow her name to be on the book, The Population Bomb, late 1960s. It seems as if a lot of people are interested in not having children. It seems that evolution by natural selection has appointed, in this and many other cases, the wrong one. It's far too late for a substantial reduction in the human population to turn around climate change.
But of course,
it's a combination of the number of bodies and the amount of consumption by those bodies. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to run on the campaign of stopping breathing. I pretty much guarantee it.
And we've only got a couple minutes left, so we're pretty much out of time. I always like to make the observation that, you know, the whole issue of population is so fraught with controversy because, you know, it's what's really obviously driving all this is a technological way of life that permits both population expansion and expansion of the technosphere itself. But as I said, we're about out of time. One last thought before I give your, again, where are you going to be speaking in Portland?
Yes, and you have that information at your disposal, and I don't have it in front of me, so fire away, please.
Okay, so Guy McPherson, who is coming to the Pacific Northwest next week, will be at the Waypost on Northeast Williams. It's on the page, KBOO.FM. Look at this program. Wednesday Talk Radio, and from 6:30 to 9 p.m. next Monday, August 8th, at the Waypost on Northeast Williams. Mm-hmm. So we're about flush out of time. Thanks for sticking with us, Guy, and for calling back on a slightly better line. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll see you next week.
All right. And again, that was Guy McPherson talking about the dire effects of climate change, abrupt climate change, and whether or not we can do anything about it, and what's really going on. That's all for today's Wednesday Talk Radio. Your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned for more programming here on KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, A Letter from Momo, will play Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. A Letter to Momo has been described as a Japanese anime Alice in Wonderland. As is so often the case in Japanese animation, displacement and emotional upheaval lead to interaction with the supernatural. Again, that's A Letter from Momo, Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, Dave Mazza talks with former Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper about his latest book, Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Stamper gives his insider look at how racism and violence is perpetuated.